these websites to read the next day's stories that just got posted. Begin emailing with other colleagues to craft responses to any problems or email reporters to fight for changes to any inaccurate or unappealing parts of those stories. Eventually go to bed, rinse, repeat. On Christmas Eve in 2009, right after the Senate passed the latest version of the Affordable Care Act, I stopped by the office of White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel. I was about to head out of town for my first days off since Barack Obama had won the nomination. I wanted to check in before heading for the train station. Rahm was a top advisor in the famously chaotic Clinton White House for more than 6 years, where he dealt with countless calamities, including the effort to impeach the president. As I was bidding him farewell, Rahm looked up from his BlackBerry, rubbed his eyes, and said, "This year felt longer than all my years in the Clinton White House combined." The reason? Everything was moving faster than ever before. Politics and government were now operating at the speed of the never-ending news cycle. What used to take weeks now happened in a matter of hours. When you used to have a day to respond, you now had minutes, if you were lucky. And it's only gotten worse since then. Much, much worse. The Trump media environment emerges. Late in 2014, after a particularly rough period politically for the president, Obama called me into the Oval Office for a chat. He was rightly frustrated about the state of our communications operation. In 2008, we were so far ahead of the curve. Governing is harder than campaigning, but for most of our time here, we have at least kept pace with the change. Lately, it feels like we've fallen behind. I had been anticipating this chat because the president was correct. We have been on the defensive for the last 18 months. Every time we would get a little momentum, something would knock us back on our heels. And we paid the price of the ballot box, losing the Senate and handing full control of Congress to the Republicans. The old tricks weren't working anymore. I hatched a plan with Dennis McDonough. In the past, our challenges had been execution-related, and we could address them with the usual tools available to us. This felt like a more existential challenge. Something fundamental had changed in the media environment. I needed to figure out what had changed and what we should do about it. I needed help. For most of my time working for Obama, whenever we encountered some beltway political crisis that dominated cable news, we would ask focus groups of voters if they had heard anything about it. Almost every single time, they had no idea what we were talking about. There were things Washington got worked up about and things the American people cared about, and rarely did those things overlap. But something had changed. Suddenly, focus groups knew all about the trivial things that Washington would get worked up over, and they knew about them in great detail, often reading back to the moderator what sounded like Republican talking points or a Fox News story, which are actually the same thing. When the moderator asked them where they learned this information, the answer was almost always the same: Facebook. By 2016, the media ecosystem of 2008 was impossible to recognize. It was the perfect petri dish for a fungus like Trumpism to grow. Trump understood that there were no rules and referees, and that a good story was much more valuable than an accurate one. Trump's main media experiences are the absurdity of reality television and the no-holds-barred world of Big Apple tabloid journalism. Sadly, these were the perfect experiences to compete for president in 2016. In hindsight, it seems obvious that Trump would thrive in this environment. The hints were there all along, going back way before he even ran. To grapple with these changes, I propose going to Silicon Valley and New York to pick the brains of the smartest people in tech and media to better understand the current state of affairs and where things might be going. I went to Google, Twitter, YouTube, LinkedIn, and everywhere in between. I met with the venture capitalists who were looking for the next Google and Facebook. The gravity of the challenge before us came in a meeting in Silicon Valley when I explained the difficulty in getting our message out in the fragmented media environment, and one of the executives from a Silicon Valley giant responded, "We have been wondering the same thing and hoped you had some good ideas." Chapter 5. Fighting Fake News. On a dreary morning in April 2011, I found myself facing sleep-addled reporters in a half-empty White House briefing room. From the earliest days of my career, I had dreamed about standing at this very spot. The podium, as it's known to everyone in Washington, is the top of the game. It's like the mound at Fenway for a ball player. If you're standing there, you have made it. The White House briefing room is one of the most famous rooms in the world. History has been made in this room more times than one can count. I had long thought about what it would mean to be in this exact spot as a senior White House aide. This was supposed to be a big moment for me, but as I walked up to the podium, I thought to myself, was I there to announce important new government policy? Nope. Was I there to joust with the media about the issues that mattered? Nah. was I there to respond to the mad ravings of a conspiracy theory-spreading reality television star? Bingo. I had walked into the briefing room that morning with 50 copies of Barack Obama's birth certificate, so we could prove once and for all that the man who was in his third year as president after winning a historic electoral landslide was an American citizen eligible to be president. The term fake news was not yet part of the political lexicon, but this might very well have been the moment when it rose from something that elicited an eye roll to something that necessitated a full-throated response from the White House. The era of hashtag fake news was born. What is hashtag fake news? Fake news may now be on the tip of everyone's tongue, especially President Trump's, but it didn't just magically appear in 2016. The battle against fake news was a defining element of the Obama era. We dealt with it, worried about it, and were disheartened by it from the very beginning of the campaign. It's something Donald Trump played a large role in perpetuating long before he was a candidate for president, and it just may have cost Hillary Clinton the White House. But what is fake news? Like so much in politics these days, it's way more confusing than it should be, since it has several meanings. In the months before the 2016 election, the following stories went viral. Pope Francis shocks the world, endorses Donald Trump for president. WikiLeaks confirms that Hillary sent weapons to ISIS. FBI director received millions from the Clinton Foundation. ISIS leader calls for American Muslims to support Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton in 2013. I would like to see people like Donald Trump run for office. They're honest and can't be bought. Each of these stories received more than 500,000 engagements on Facebook, much greater than factual articles from the New York Times, Washington Post, and other outlets during the same period. And they were all complete, unadulterated bullshit. In these cases, these stories were completely made up by outside actors, including the Russians, and then spread on Facebook to influence the election. There is also the screaming of fake news at any piece of information that one doesn't like, even, and often, when it is undeniably true. This is in some ways a defense mechanism for our infantile and insecure president, but it has an even more alarming purpose. The point is to signal to Trump's most diehard supporters to dismiss any piece of news that is bad for Trump, even if it is objectively and obviously true. When it was revealed that Donald Trump Jr., Trump's oldest son and the Fredo of the Trump clan, was corresponding with someone representing the Russian government about their efforts to help Trump win, Trump supporters refused to believe the story and questioned the authenticity of the emails, even though they were released by Fredo himself. However one chooses to define it, the fake news phenomenon is about the country moving into an era of post-truth politics, and 2016 was the tipping point. In the past, even the slipperiest politicians adhered to a plausible deniability of dishonesty. Instead of outright lying, they would put some measure of spin on a set of facts. Sometimes the spin was so absurd that it was hard to distinguish it from a lie. But at the end of the day, it was rooted in some truth, even if it perverted that truth beyond recognition. Trump was a wholly different entity. He was unburdened by the shame that keeps most people from outright lying. The media and the Clinton campaign were entirely unprepared to deal with something like this. Trump didn't play by the rules. He couldn't be chastened by criticism or persuaded by facts. In 2016, Trump and his team, foreign and domestic, were able to take this one step further and use Facebook to weaponize his lies and spread fake news far and wide. But like so much with Trump, it's easy to forget that Trump is a symptom, not the disease that affects the body politic. The underlying causes of the fake news phenomenon have been building for years, and they were a defining element of the Obama era. Even if we didn't use the term fake news, we dealt with the seeds of the post-truth era from the very beginning of Obama's first campaign. The battle against birtherism. When I pictured my debut in the White House briefing room, I did not imagine that it would be for such an absurd reason. Serious things were happening in the world. We had two active wars. Europe was on the brink of a financial crisis that could collapse the U.S. economy. We were headed into a major legislative showdown with a new Republican majority in Congress that had massive implications for the future of the country. Yet nearly every time the president or any White House official took questions from the media, they were asked to respond to whatever absurdity had come out of Trump's mouth in his latest appearances on the Today Show or Fox and Friends. In all fairness, most of the time the reporters were sheepish when they asked the question. These were serious people who had joined a serious profession to cover serious issues, being forced to ask an unserious question because of the never-ending search for ratings, clicks, and retweets. But nonetheless, the President of the United States was being forced to respond to a reality TV star less relevant than The Real Housewives. This is admittedly deeply unfair to The Real Housewives, all of whom would have been a better president, especially Bethany Frankel. Beyond the abject absurdity of the messenger, the claim that the president wasn't born in the United States, which came to be known as birtherism, was a particularly kooky conspiracy theory. Birtherism wasn't new when Trump turned it into a crusade. It had been around since the early days of the campaign. It was the subject of a series of malicious email chains that were being forwarded around the internet. These emails contained a wide array of false and particularly ridiculous information about Obama, including Obama was born in Kenya. Obama was educated in a madrasa during his time living in Indonesia as a small child. Obama was sworn into office in the Senate using a Quran instead of a Bible. Obama was not the son of Barack Obama Sr., but was the son of African-American activist and socialist Frank Marshall Davis. This was the era of journalism before social media, so the media mostly responsibly refused to cover the emails. They would check out the rumors, find them to be ridiculous, and then refuse to amplify them. Despite the mainstream media blackout, birtherism was gaining a disturbing amount of traction among some of the voters in rural Iowa, which hosted the critical First in the Nation caucus. Our field organizers were getting questions from the voters they were contacting. Most of the questions were well-intentioned. Democratic primary voters were scarred from consecutive losses and were viewing this information through the prism of Obama's electability. If we nominate Obama and this information comes out, will the Republicans win again? Our field staff would tell people it's not true, but they wanted proof both to soothe their own concerns but also to share with their friends and family. So we made the decision to post Obama's certificate of live birth on the internet. This was not an easy decision. It ran counter to one of the cardinal rules of political communications. Don't give oxygen to malicious rumors. It's better to ignore them than dignify them with a response that would catapult rumors from the dark corners of the internet to the front pages of the New York Times. But that rule, like most of the rules that govern public relations strategy, was written before the internet. To a certain extent, this tactic worked. The voters who wanted to support Obama were mollified by this information. Like all campaigns, we focus all our energy and resources on the people who might support our candidate. These are the people whose doors our organizers knocked and phones they called. It's one of the realities of campaigns that you cannot afford to spend any energy talking to voters or campaigning in states that will never support your candidate. Therefore, we didn't have any insight into how the far right of the Republican base was feeling about Obama's citizenship. As far as I was concerned, the issue had been put to bed. Once we got to the White House, we were inundated with the more serious issues that come with running the world, and I didn't think about those old campaign rumors. Every once in a while, I would get called up to the White House counsel's office to get a briefing, because a collection of crackpots had sued the president to challenge the legitimacy of the election over the birther issue. The lawyers told us not to worry about it, and I didn't. While we were focused on things like saving the economy and passing a health care bill, however, the right-wing fringe was in overdrive. They had become convinced that the certificate of live birth we'd released during the campaign was a forgery. A major part of the conspiracy centered on the difference between the certificate of live birth we released and his long-form birth certificate, which was on file with the state of Hawaii. It's hard to overstate how dumb a discrepancy this is, but it's also hard to overstate how dumb the far right of the Republican Party can be. And then Donald Trump, a man whose depraved desire for attention would make a Kardashian blush, latched onto the cause. Trump was embarking on a press tour to promote the next season of The Celebrity Apprentice and was looking for ways to juice up the middling ratings of the show. He was even floating a presidential run, which is an old PR tactic for tricking the media into covering you. Almost no one took the idea that Trump was going to run seriously. He had employed this gambit before, but all the media needed was an excuse to put Trump on the air to say absurd things. And he certainly obliged again and again. Early on in this effort, he realized that he could get even more attention if he brought up the birther conspiracy. All of a sudden, the media could talk only about Donald Trump and the president's birth certificate, or lack thereof. Jay Carney, the White House press secretary, was being asked to respond to Trump almost daily. It was coming up in Obama's press interviews. It was becoming clear we had a problem. One day I was walking back to the Oval Office with Obama after yet another encounter with the press where he was asked to respond to questions about his birthplace. "Maybe we should put the birth certificate out and be done with this," Obama said, half in jest. Or so I thought. "That would show them. But you know we can't do that, right?" I responded, also half in jest. Obama said he agreed with me, but I could tell he didn't really mean it. I had seen this before when he was working his way to a certain position. I made a mental note to warn Pluff so that he could head it off at the pass. A few weeks later, we were on a fundraising trip to Chicago. Whenever we spent the night in Chicago, the president would stay at his house. He would often say that his Chicago home was frozen in time from the moment right before he took office. On his desk was the mail that came in January 2009 before they moved to D.C. Whenever he was home, often alone, he would root through all his stuff. On this particular trip, he was going through a box and found what he believed was his birth certificate. To this day, it isn't clear whether he stumbled upon this document or went looking for it. I have always suspected the latter. The president was excited about his find. He brought it back to the White House and showed it to Plouffe and Bob Bauer, the White House counsel. He told them that he wanted to release the birth certificate and put the issue to rest. Bauer took one look at what Obama had in his hand and knew it wasn't his actual birth certificate. Instead, the president had found a ceremonial document that is sold in hospital gift shops. This is the document that families often frame, but you can't use it to get a passport or debunk a racist conspiracy theory burning up the internet. Obama was clearly disappointed by this fact, but he was not deterred. He directed Bauer to begin the process of acquiring his official or long-form birth certificate from the state of Hawaii. He didn't commit to releasing it, but told Bauer and Plouffe to get it so we had it in our back pocket, just in case. During this period, I was living in blissful ignorance of these machinations, even though I knew the president was interested in releasing his birth certificate. This was a classic Barack Obama move. He had a tendency to want to address the elephant in the room, even if it took him off whatever we thought was the best message. His instinct was usually right. But in this instance, I couldn't bring myself to give in to Donald Trump and the band of racist nutjobs that he represented. In late April, I got a call to head up to Bauer's office. When Lauren Thorbjornsen, my assistant, asked about the topic of the meeting, she couldn't get an answer. Being called to the White House counsel's office was a lot like getting sent to the principal's office in high school. If you were there, there was a good chance you were in trouble. This was a particularly anxious time to be summoned to the White House counsel, since the Republicans had taken over Congress and were launching politicized investigations into Obama administration activities in the hopes of finding wrongdoing somewhere. They didn't find anything. We all lived in fear of being subject to a congressional subpoena, having our emails and other documents released to the world, and amassing tens of thousands of dollars in legal bills that we couldn't afford. I walked into Bauer's wood-paneled office with more than a little trepidation. Plouffe was sitting on Bauer's couch. This was another alarming sign. My boss, the lawyer, and me. This can't be good. Am I going to jail? I asked to break the ice. Almost certainly. But that's not the purpose of this meeting, Bauer responded with trademark sarcasm. They probably don't make this joke in the Trump White House, since some of them are undoubtedly going to transition from the White House to the Big House. As I sat down on the couch, Bauer started explaining how he'd ended up requesting the president's long-form birth certificate from the state of Hawaii, and how the president was intent on releasing it to the public. As I processed this piece of information, Plouffe chimed in to say that the president wanted to go into the White House briefing room to release it himself. Well, that's fucking crazy, I said. Plouffe explained that the president wanted to use this opportunity to take the conversation to a bigger idea beyond the birth certificate. He wanted to talk about the danger of the political conversation getting diverted by these side issues. This was a better idea than simply going before the nation and saying, hey, look, I'm American, deal with it. But I was still horrified by the thought of the president being forced to go before the nation and defend his own legitimacy. It felt beneath him. It felt beneath the office. I could already read all the headlines and tweets to come about how this made Obama look weak. I tried to make my case, but I could tell by the look on his face that Plouffe had made these points to the president and had not prevailed. The basic message was, take your case to the big guy. And oh yeah, he wants to release the birth certificate in the next 2 days, Plouffe added. Later that day, I went to the Oval Office loaded for bear. The president was seated behind his desk, reading some memos. Before I could get my first sentence out, Obama said without even looking up from his papers, I bet you don't love my idea. I knew I had lost the argument. Obama had already played out all the scenarios in his head and come to a conclusion. I wasn't going to tell him some angle that he hadn't already thought of. I beat a strategic retreat. Instead of trying to convince the president not to release the birth certificate, I focused my energy on two things. First, separating him from the actual release. I proposed that Bauer and I provide it to the media at a briefing, then later that morning Obama could deliver his message to the world in a speech. This would hardly address my major political concerns, but would at least keep Obama from having to answer a bunch of logistical questions about how we got the birth certificate. Second, I argued that the release should be a surprise. If we announced it in advance, the press would lose its collective shit and there would be a CNN countdown clock ticking down to the second of release. In the age of the internet, where a million things are happening at the same time and everything is dissected and analyzed before it even happens, one of the only ways to break through is to catch the world by surprise. He agreed with my recommendations, and I headed back to my office to plot out how to execute this newly hatched plan. My desire for surprise meant we had to avoid leaks at all costs, which meant we would have a very tight circle for this plan. The president's top advisors and a couple of members of the press staff would need to pull it off without letting anyone else know. So on that sleepy morning, I walked into a nearly empty briefing room. It seemed that many reporters had assumed it would be a typical newsless briefing and decided to skip it. Even many of the reporters who had decided to come to work that day couldn't be bothered to walk the 100 feet from their workspace to listen in. Then one of the press assistants started handing out copies of the birth certificate. All hell broke loose. There were audible gasps. People immediately started emailing their news desk to tell them that, quote, real news was being made. The reporters who had planned on skipping the briefing were tripping over one another as they sprinted to their seats to get in on the action. After everyone was in place, I read a statement that explained the difference between the document we'd released in 2008 and the one we were releasing today. The reporters assembled before me were equal parts shocked, amused, and ashamed at the spectacle that was unfolding. The media's reaction was not different than my own. I couldn't help but laugh at the absurdity of the whole thing, but I was also embarrassed by the state of my chosen field. In the back of my mind, I wondered if I was standing there due to some failure on my part. Was there something I could have done that would have prevented the president from having to convince a decent part of the country of his American citizenship? The media responded to the release of the birth certificate with the professionalism of a pack of rabid hyenas. All of the cable news switched to nonstop coverage. Trump was coincidentally headed to New Hampshire that morning for a speech, which added to the drama. We had turned a quiet day into a major news event. A couple of hours later, the president came to the briefing room to lay out his case.
Now, normally, I would not comment on something like this, but 2 weeks ago when the Republican House had put forward a budget that will have huge consequences potentially to the country, and when I gave a speech about my budget and how I felt that we needed to invest in education and infrastructure and making sure that we had a strong safety net for our seniors, even as we were closing the deficit. During that entire week, the dominant news story wasn't about these huge monumental choices that we're going to have to make as a nation. It was about my birth certificate. But we're not going to be able to do it if we are distracted. We're not going to be able to do it if we spend time vilifying each other. We're not going to be able to do it if we just make stuff up and pretend that facts are not facts. We're not going to be able to solve our problems if we get distracted by sideshows and carnival barkers.
As I sat in one of the chairs on the side of the briefing room reserved for staff to watch the spectacle, I knew the president had been right, and I had been wrong. He was making an important point. This was not the first, and wouldn't be the last time, that Obama's unconventional approach to politics had proven to be more prescient than my own. The release of the birth certificate shut up Trump to the extent that was possible. The reporters covering his faux campaign visit peppered him with questions about how wrong he was regarding Obama's birthplace. The media that had been party to Trump's absurdity turned on him with a vengeance. While there were some who thought we had made a strategic error, the bulk of the coverage applauded Obama for how he'd handled a less than ideal situation. A few nights later was the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where the president gives an annual comedic speech, and Trump was going to be in the audience. We had been planning to make a number of jokes about Trump and the birth certificate issue before the decision was made to release the document. My first stop after the president gave me my marching orders was Favreau's office. He had been working on the speech for weeks with John Lovett, Axelrod, and a collection of comedians and joke writers. The speech was almost done, then I showed up with the information that would upend the whole process. Favreau's first reaction was to curse me for fucking up his process about 48 hours before he owed a draft to the president. But he quickly realized the golden comedic opportunity it presented. It was an open question if releasing the birth certificate would forever demean the office of the president and hurt our chances for re-election, but there was no question we were going to have an epic Correspondents' Dinner speech. During the dinner, the president brought the house down with joke after joke about Trump, who sat in his seat refusing to laugh. He reportedly got up to leave not long after this joke, which went to the abject absurdity of Trump's credentials as a potential president.
Now, I know that he's taken some flack lately, but no one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And where are Biggie and Tupac? All kidding aside, obviously we all know about your credentials and breadth of experience. Just recently, in an episode of Celebrity Apprentice, at the steakhouse, the men's cooking team did not impress the judges from Omaha Steaks. And there was a lot of blame to go around, but you, Mr. Trump, recognized that the real problem was a lack of leadership. And so ultimately, you didn't blame Little John or Meatloaf. You fired Gary Busey. And these are the kind of decisions that would keep me up at night. Well handled, sir. Well handled.
And then the night after the dinner, President Obama stood in the East Room of the White House and announced that a unit of Navy SEALs had killed Osama bin Laden on his order. Trump had been ushered off the national stage in humiliation, his foray into politics forever ended, or so we thought. Here's the bad news. Years later, 4 in 10 Republican voters still believed that Barack Obama was not born in the United States. And it's not that they didn't know about the birth certificate that was released, it's that they refused to believe it. They thought it was a forgery. If the mainstream media said it was real, then the mainstream media was lying to cover up for Obama. We had shamed the media into stopping their nonstop, uncritical coverage of Trump's claims, but we hadn't convinced a lot of people about the truth. They couldn't hear what Obama was saying because Obama was saying it. And therein lay the problem. The birth certificate imbroglio was Obama's highest profile battle with fake news, but it wasn't the only one. Over the years, we faced several conspiracy theories propagated by conservative media figures who were believed by an alarmingly significant portion of the populace. The rumors about Obama's legitimacy were mostly advanced by figures on the fringes of the Republican Party. Notably, establishment figures refused to disavow these conspiracy theories for fear of upsetting their base, but they wanted to avoid being labeled a, quote, birther. In other words, they wanted weaponized racial animus stoked by people like Trump without being called a racist. In 2012, Mitt Romney made the pilgrimage to Trump Tower to beg for the endorsement of the birther-in-chief. This was a sign of things to come. Republicans moved their HQ to the grassy knoll. During the battle to pass the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, in 2009, we saw the first example of mainstream figures utilizing fake news or a false conspiracy theory to advance a specific policy goal. In a 2009 meeting in the Roosevelt Room, prior to kicking off the effort to pass health care reform, David Axelrod presented President Obama with his political analysis of the issue. David made it very clear that even in the most ideal scenario, where we passed the bill quickly and without a lot of fuss, the president would take a big hit, with consequences for the midterm elections the next year and potentially Obama's re-election in 2012. David was not trying to convince Obama not to take on health care. As the father of a daughter with epilepsy, he believed passionately in fixing the injustices in our healthcare system that denied health care to people like his daughter. David wanted the president and the rest of the senior White House team to know what we were getting into. Obama's response was pretty simple. What's the point of amassing political capital if you aren't willing to use it to help people? He pointed out to us that if we didn't try to pass a law to give access to health care to the uninsured, on the heels of a landslide election win with huge majorities in Congress, that it would never get done. If not now, when? Obama asked. There was only one answer to that question. We knew from the failed efforts that came before that healthcare policy was uniquely susceptible to demagoguery. Fear of the unknown greatly exceeded the public's concerns about the present system. This factor was the one that was most concerning to me. Be prepared for some of the obvious criticisms of any healthcare bill. Is it a government takeover of healthcare? Will it raise your taxes? Will it raise your premiums? Etc. Here's one we didn't prepare for. Obamacare will kill you. I was sitting in my office during a quiet day in August when I got forwarded an email from someone in the White House Legislative Affairs Office asking for talking points to respond to Sarah Palin's allegation about, quote, death panels in our healthcare bill. Congress had just left town for the month-long August break, and as far as I could tell, the only people working in Washington were in the West Wing with me. It was also the habit of our Legislative Affairs staff, as we called them, to treat any request from Congress, whether it was a request for a bill signing, a White House tour, or talking points from an intern, as if it were a five-alarm fire. Do I really need to drop what I am doing because some junior staffer for a no-name member of Congress thought it was cool to call the White House? And to top it all off, it was Sarah Palin, who had gone from sensation as Alaska governor and GOP vice presidential candidate to national joke in record time. Palin was last seen delivering her annual Thanksgiving turkey pardoning speech, while behind her, a farmer was putting turkeys one by one into the slaughter machine. Included in the email was a text of something Palin had posted on Facebook earlier in the day. The Democrats promise that a government healthcare system will reduce the cost of healthcare. But as the economist Thomas Sowell has pointed out, government healthcare will not reduce the cost. It will simply refuse to pay the cost. And who will suffer the most when they ration care? The sick, the elderly, and the disabled, of course. The America I know and love is not one in which my parents or my baby with Down syndrome will have to stand in front of Obama's death panel so his bureaucrats can decide based on a subjective judgment of their level of productivity in society whether they are worthy of healthcare. Such a system is downright evil. While no one in the media took Palin seriously, she still had a devoted following on the far right. Her post had caused a stir, and members of Congress had started to get calls. I had a decent handle on the details of the healthcare bill making its way through Congress, and I had no clue what Palin was talking about. I dismissed it as gibberish, forwarded the email to someone on the research staff, and went home for the weekend. Although I didn't realize it at the time, Palin was referring to a revision in the law that provided Medicare funding for voluntary consultations with doctors about hospice and other, quote, end-of-life care options. This was an innocuous policy that had previously received bipartisan support. Now, in hindsight, using the term end-of-life was a terrible idea. But in a world where facts and truth reign supreme, it would be impossible to turn this into forced euthanasia for the elderly. But alas, we did not live in that world. Because Congress was on recess, the members were spending time back in their districts. More and more people were coming to their events and asking about these death panels. The idea took off like wildfire. People believed it and were scared. Unlike the birther controversy, Republican leaders didn't stay away. They jumped at the opportunity to score political points. The Republican leader of the House, John Boehner, issued a statement a few weeks later that said, "This provision may start us down a treacherous path toward government-encouraged euthanasia if enacted into law." Boehner knew what he was saying was complete bullshit. He just didn't care. He saw an opportunity to cynically exploit people's fears and went for it. In August, Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, who is the top Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, which is helping write the Senate version of the health bill and had been discussing a potential compromise with Obama, was confronted by a constituent sincerely concerned about the rumored death panels in the health care bill. Grassley, who was intimately familiar with health care policy and certainly knew the truth, had two options at that moment. Tell his constituent the truth and reassure them, or try to score political points. Grassley chose the latter, telling the constituent that, "You have every right to fear. We should not have a government-run plan to decide when to pull the plug on grandma." Obama wanting to pull the plug on granny became a common GOP talking point, amplified 24/7 on conservative talk radio and Fox News. One day Sarah Palin posts on Facebook, and before we know it, we have a full-blown political crisis on our hands. I was a deputy communications director at the White House at the time, auditioning for the top job. Once the death panel rumors started and our political prospects had started to go south, Rahm and Anita Dunn, who had become the interim White House communications director, asked me to oversee the communications regarding health care. My charge was to, quote, bring some Obama campaign-style rapid response tactics to the fight for health care. Step one was to set up a website specifically dedicated to responding to these false attacks. Obamacare is a not-so-secret strategy to kill old people was the highest profile and most pernicious attack, but it was far from the only one. Republicans would repeat ad nauseum that our plan would increase the deficit, even though it was completely paid for through a combination of tax increases and spending cuts. They alleged that it would cut the Medicare benefits that seniors depend on, also completely false. We needed a one-stop shop where people could come for the truth and our allies could easily find the talking points and other information they needed to respond to questions. We started using the work done by fact-checking sites such as PolitiFact and factcheck.org to set the record straight and call out specific politicians for perpetuating this lie. A major effort was made to shame the major news outlets into running stories that debunk the claim. We deployed surrogates to local TV stations via satellite. We even had the president address the death panel accusation in a nationally televised address before Congress that was watched by 32 million Americans. These efforts had an immediate impact. The media began to challenge Republicans that brought up death panels. Most important, we calmed the waters with the Democratic members who were afraid that we were marching them off to slaughter without a plan to fight back. Here's the problem we didn't solve, though. A decent number of people still believed that our health care bill included death panels. They had been presented with facts from independent arbiters, experts, the media, and other politicians, yet they couldn't be convinced to stop believing something so obviously untrue. Every time President Obama or the New York Times told them the truth, Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh would tell them the opposite. For this part of the populace, Obama and the mainstream media were disqualified as messengers. 6 years after the law was passed, 29% of voters, nearly all Republican, still believed that the law included death panels. One would have hoped that after the law was passed and no death panels had convened, people would come around to the truth. Not a chance. The perfect Petri dish. The eventual passage of health care and the short-term humiliation of Donald Trump over his birtherism were the beginning, not the end, of the phenomenon of fake news. The situation got much worse in the 2016 election, and even worse in the early years of the Trump presidency. We elected a conspiracy theorist as commander-in-chief. In the early days of his presidency, Trump falsely claimed that millions of illegal votes were cast in the 2016 election, and falsely claimed that Barack Obama had wiretapped his phones. In the campaign, he accused Senator Ted Cruz's father of being involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Snake oil salesmen like Donald Trump pushing conspiracy theories are nothing new in politics, but they have never been more powerful than they are now. It's not that America is getting dumber. It's that changes in media and technology have weaponized the worst parts of our politics. First, distrust in the media sowed by generations of Republican politicians screaming liberal bias has reduced the ability of the media to serve as referees in factual disputes. For many conservative voters, the New York Times, CNN, or the Washington Post stating a fact is actually proof positive that said fact is not true. They believe, as Donald Trump so disturbingly stated early in his presidency, that the press is the enemy of the American people. Theoretically, the conservative media could have stepped in and fought for the concept of objective truth. But led by Fox News, they decided to exploit this very belief for profit and partisan gain. We saw this time and again in the 2016 election. Trump would be accused of everything from sexual assault to rank corruption to bold-faced lies with detailed fact-based reporting. And he would slip the political news every time because his voters believed the media was engaged in a conspiracy to bring down a conservative politician. Second, the emergence of Facebook as the primary news source for so many Americans has made it easier for these conspiracy theories to spread across the country in a matter of seconds. Reading the news within Facebook makes it easy to confuse a credible news source with completely fake news or distorted partisan talking points. Facebook tends to promote the stories that draw the most controversy or elicit the most emotional response. The hucksters and political saboteurs pushing an agenda with stuff like birtherism are trying to push the emotional buttons that make stories go viral. Sarah Palin knew exactly what she was doing by posting the death panel theory on Facebook. She would have been laughed off the set if she had done it on Meet the Press or Good Morning America, but on Facebook, the outrageous is rewarded. Winning the battle against bullshit. We have a plague affecting our democracy that is getting worse by the day. Is there anything we can do about it? There are no easy answers. The fact that one of our two political parties now openly traffics in provably false conspiracy theories as a primary political strategy poses a threat to our system of government. This may sound dramatic, but if anything, it understates the problem. The American system of government operates on a set of norms, and if one party decides to regularly violate those norms in order to acquire more power, it cripples the ability to respond to disasters like hurricanes, threats like North Korea, and existential challenges like climate change. The Republican approach is one of immense cynicism and utter cowardice, but there is nothing I have seen in 20 years in politics that suggests Republicans are going to change their stripes anytime soon. Russia clearly played a huge role in promoting the conspiracy theories that dominated the conversation in 2016 in order to help Trump win. All of our intelligence agencies agree with this assessment. Congressional Republicans agree with this assessment. Yet, Somehow this still seems up for debate. Why? Because there is one person in government who doesn't agree, Donald Trump, which should tell you everything you need to know. It is alarming that Russia was willing to be so aggressive, but it's even more alarming that such an absurd strategy worked. The Russians were pushing on an open door. Even if the government was able to stop the Russians from ever doing this again, we now have a conspiracy theorist in chief in the Oval Office. Pure propaganda is the official strategy of the Republican Party. And if Democrats don't figure out how to combat it, we will be relegated to the opposition for years to come while Republicans flush the country down the toilet. Here are some lessons from Barack Obama's encounters with the purveyors of fake news that can be applied to the battles to come. Nothing is too crazy not to believe. It's easy to think some of the stuff circulating on the right is too crazy for anyone other than the fringe to believe, but that's a huge mistake. I was wrong to dismiss the idea that anyone would believe that Obama wanted to pass a law to kill old people, and we paid a huge price for letting it fester. We live in a time when the President of the United States is willing to use his Twitter account to spread lies to millions of his supporters who are willing to believe anything he says. Every conspiracy theory, no matter how ridiculous, must be taken seriously and responded to by the media and Democratic politicians before it takes off. The traditional calculus of being afraid of giving additional attention to the crazy stuff is an anachronism in the social media age. If fake news is the disease, Facebook is the carrier. All of the fake news stories mentioned earlier in this chapter spread across the populace through Facebook. For many Americans, Facebook is the internet. It's how they keep up with friends, it's how they communicate, and it's how they get the vast majority of the news. The problem is that despite being the primary news source for a lot of people, Facebook is not a media company in the traditional sense. They don't have editors or fact checkers. For financial reasons, Facebook values content that engages users over all else for the simple reason that they want you to stay on Facebook for as long as possible so they can show you more ads. Facebook doesn't show you everything your Facebook friends post. They only show content the algorithm thinks you will engage with. In the most simplistic of terms, Facebook defines engagement as the sum total of shares, likes, and comments. In a reflection of our highly polarized political times, holy shit stories like Pope endorses Trump generate a ton of engagement and are therefore shown to more people. The stories written by the mainstream media or the campaign-authored posts that debunk these stories receive exponentially less engagement and are therefore seen by exponentially fewer people. Facebook has pledged to fix this problem, and I think they are very sincere in that pledge. But it's a little like the NFL's pledge to deal with concussions. To do so would fundamentally change a very successful business, so it's unlikely to happen anytime soon. Democrats cannot wait around for Mark Zuckerberg to fix their problems. First, we need to monitor Facebook more closely to track the spread of these stories and memes. And second, we need to develop fact checks and counter-messaging that generates enough engagement to be seen by as many people as possible. The next election will be fought on Facebook. Everyone is a fact checker. The fake news stories spread across the populace via Facebook and Twitter. But those same platforms give agency to everyone to lead the fight for truth. People are scrolling through their Facebook feed, seeing posts about where Obama was or wasn't born, or alleging some made-up act of corruption by the Clintons. They don't click on the post to see where the story was from or whether it's credible, and depending on the Facebook algorithm or the makeup of their social network, they may be seeing these same false stories multiple times a day. Absent Facebook hiring millions of fact-checkers to comb the platform, the only solution is to fight back. Multiple studies show that people are most likely to believe news if it comes from someone they personally know. Therefore, there is great power and people sharing on social media the stories and fact checks that debunk the lies being spread by Trump and his friends and the Republican fringe media. Democratic politicians need to build tools to make this easier for their supporters, but there is no reason we have to wait for that. Play a different game. Ultimately, the right strategy is to nullify the idea of objective truth. On issues such as climate change, healthcare, and tax policy, Republicans simply can't win an argument on the facts. So instead of changing their policy, they try to change the facts. Democrats could look at the relative success of Trump and decide to play his game. This would be a mistake. Cynical conspiracy theories are the Republicans' home turf, which we wouldn't be good at. Our supporters, who still trust objective news sources, wouldn't be fooled. Instead, we should swerve in the other direction and abandon normal political spin to ensure that our statements, positions, and analyses of the other side are factually bulletproof. The smallest error will allow Republicans to call the truth fake news, but we have the power to deny them that opportunity. Whenever one opens up Twitter and turns on the TV and sees some Republican congressman screaming about some made-up scandal that they learned about on Fox News, or denying the very idea of climate change as America is hammered by hurricanes, it's easy to feel despondent about the future of the country. I feel that way sometimes too, but then I catch myself. There's some very good reasons to be hopeful about the future. It's easy to forget that it wasn't that long ago that we had a president and an administration that strove to tell the truth and make fact-based arguments. And the public rewarded that president with an overwhelming re-election and high approval ratings. We are still at the beginning of the internet age. The power and reach of new platforms like Facebook and Twitter are not yet fully understood, and savvy actors have the opportunity to exploit them with malicious activity. A good portion of Americans, particularly the older ones who vote most often, did not grow up on the internet. Their experience is from a different era, where one had reason to trust the things they read in the news. Most important, millennials are going to save us from ourselves. The millennial generation is about to become the most powerful force in politics, and they are equal parts internet savvy and skeptical. They were raised on the internet. They have a natural and well-earned skepticism of what they read online, as well as the skills to verify or debunk anything. As millennials become a larger part of the electorate, the propaganda tactics of the right are going to be less and less effective. In the meantime, Democrats must learn the lessons of Obama's battles with fake news, conspiracy theories, and con men. We cannot expect to win power again until we have figured out how to defeat the propaganda forces that created, elected, and are now propping up Trump. It's that simple. No pressure, but the fate of the free world, or at least this part of it, is at stake. Interlude 2. My beautiful, dark, twisted White House fantasy. One of the cool parts of working in the White House is that you get to meet the most interesting people in the world. My top three are as follows. The Queen of England, the Pope, the cool one, not the other one, Kanye West. Kanye is the best story, so that's the one I will tell. We were flying on Air Force One for a fundraising trip to California in 2014 when Anita Breckinridge, President Obama's deputy chief of staff and longtime gatekeeper, got an email from someone on the White House political staff. The host wants to bring Kanye West and Kim Kardashian to the event. They will write checks. Are we okay with this? Showing me the email, Anita then said, "Are you okay with this?" I was torn. Kanye on paper passes all our vetting tests. He says outrageous things, but hadn't been in legal trouble or been part of any sort of embarrassing scandal. I'm also a huge Kanye fan. He can be insufferable at times, no question, but Kanye is without a doubt a genius. I love his music. I've been to a half dozen of his concerts over the years, and I'm generally just fascinated by someone who seems to be simultaneously the most and least self-aware person alive. But the actual problem I was thinking about was that Obama and Kanye had had a blow-up of sorts a few years before. Several days after Kanye famously interrupted Taylor Swift at the MTV Video Music Awards, Obama was chatting with John Harwood of CNBC before an interview, when Harwood asked him if he had seen what Kanye had done. "I thought it was really inappropriate," Obama responded offhandedly. "He's a jackass." The cameras weren't on, but the microphones were, and the audio was being fed to the White House pool. An ABC reporter, violating the off-the-record nature of the comments, tweeted them out, and the world went nuts. Even though Kanye had been a big supporter of our 2008 campaign, flying across the country with Jay-Z to do concerts to encourage people to vote, Obama and Kanye had had no contact in the years since the jackass flare-up. Kanye was as unpredictable as they come, and I was worried that he would use the fundraiser to go after Obama. And if that exchange leaked out, it would dominate the media for days. "Let's tell them no and see what happens," I told Anita. The response was quick. The host said they would cancel if Kim and Kanye couldn't come. We gave in pretty quick. Kimye would be in attendance. As a general rule, I hate fundraising events. I would always prefer to sit in the staff office than mix and mingle with donors. But there was not a chance I was going to miss this one. The event was a round table of about 25 people arrayed on deep leather couches and folding chairs in the wood panel library of a huge L.A. mansion. Kanye and Kim were seated on the couch closest to Obama, and I was seated with the staff in the back of the room. The format of these types of events was that Obama gave some brief opening remarks and then took questions from the donors who had paid a pretty penny to be there. Leonardo DiCaprio went first, asking a substantive question about how to convince the American people about the reality and severity of climate change. For the next hour, the donors peppered Obama with questions about politics and policy. I went to a lot of fundraisers with Leo, and he consistently asked some of the smartest questions. Believe it or not, Ashton Kutcher is also on the smartest questions from a celebrity list. "I have time for one more question," Obama said to the donors. I had one eye on Kanye and one on my BlackBerry. The event was wrapping up, and I was a little annoyed that I had sat in this painfully uncomfortable chair for an hour. I had hurt my back playing basketball, and sitting for long periods of time was incredibly painful. I was willing to endure the back pain for the great story of a Kanye rant, but time was running out. Then it happened. Kanye's hand shot up. Obama's face was frozen in a look of alarm and amusement as he girded himself for whatever came next. "Last question goes to Kanye," Obama said. Kanye took a deep breath and started talking. Yeezy did not disappoint. "You and I are a lot alike," Kanye said to Obama. "We are both from Chicago. When we first came on the scene, we got so much love. Now we got so many haters. And it went on like that for nearly a half hour." Some highlights. "Everyone has opponents. Coke has Pepsi. Adidas has Nike. I have Drake. You have the Republicans. The only way to get things done is to get the best people together. Me and Jay on the mic, Mario Batali on the pasta, and we need Elon Musk." I was drinking a fresh pressed juice in Japan one day when I realized that everything in Japan is designed perfectly. Japan is the Apple of countries. I was riding a bike in Shanghai when I had this thought. I was mesmerized. Obama kept a seriously inquisitive look on his face the whole time. Like all of Kanye's music, it seemed crazy at first, but before long, I was nodding along as if it made complete sense. Eventually, Kanye had to take a breath, and Obama jumped in. "Kanye, thank you for your thoughts. You make some really good points, especially about the value of meeting with smart people like Elon Musk. Thank you, everyone, for your support of the DNC. My staff is signaling from the back of the room that I'm late for my next event." After the event, I jumped in the presidential limo with Obama, Anita, and Valerie. We all looked at Obama and awaited for his assessment. What did he think of Kanye? Was he annoyed we made him sit through it? Obama had a serious look on his face. I prepared myself to try to explain how the president, who had very important work to do, had ended up in this room with rappers and movie stars. And then Obama broke into a huge grin. "That shit cray," Obama said in reference to a famous Kanye line, proving once again that he is and always will be our coolest president. We all laughed and didn't really stop until we arrived back at the White House 8 or so hours later. Chapter 6. Fox and Friends is Destroying America. "Oh, come the fuck on." That was my response to the reporter who called my cell phone to earnestly ask if I had heard about a piece of blockbuster campaign-altering news. I had been working on Obama's campaign for less than 2 weeks when the phone started to ring off the hook. We were still operating out of a windowless temporary office in D.C. My desk was a card table that was designed to fit 2 people, but had 3 people. The quarters were so tight, we had to take turns typing to avoid elbowing one another. I turned to my office mates, Robert Gibbs and Bill Burton, to tell them what I had just heard. "Guys!" But they were both on the phone, having the exact same exasperated, heated conversation that I had just had. The source of this media firestorm was a report on Fox and Friends, the network's morning show. The host had discussed with the palpable enthusiasm of kids on Christmas morning a vaguely sourced report in an obscure right-wing news outlet that said that researchers for Hillary Clinton had uncovered the fact that Obama had been educated in an Indonesian madrasa. One of the hosts, Steve Doocy, who makes Brick Tamlin look like Edward R. Murrow, declared with clownish enthusiasm that "this is huge," as he repeated the false report without ever once questioning its veracity. Doocy said that madrasas teach this Wahhabism, which pretty much hates us, then declared, "The big question is, was that on the curriculum back then?" At one point, a caller said of Obama, "Maybe he doesn't consider terrorists the enemy." And how did the hosts respond to the suggestion that a United States senator was sympathetic to Al-Qaeda? "Well, we'll see about that." Gibbs, who, unlike Tom Hagen in The Godfather, is the wartime conciliary that every candidate needs when the shit hits the fan, sprang into action. Within minutes, he was on the phone with anyone and everyone at Fox News to raise holy hell. It's safe to say that people 2 blocks away could hear Gibbs forcefully making his argument in his trademark Southern drawl. The senior executive in charge of news at Fox News eventually got back to Tommy Vietor, Gibbs' deputy, with something more akin to an excuse than an apology. He said he couldn't control Fox and Friends, one of their most watched shows, because it was, quote, entertainment programming, and the normal editorial rules didn't apply there. It's worth taking a moment to absorb that statement. The morning show was entertainment, not news. He promised to take steps to make sure this didn't happen again, which we took as seriously as O.J. Simpson's pledge to find the real killers. Eventually, the hosts submitted to public pressure and delivered a particularly insincere and unenthusiastic clarification. Everyone moved on, but the damage had already been done. Fox News had taken a scurrilous, racist, unsubstantiated rumor and injected it into the middle of a presidential campaign. This was no garden-variety journalistic mishap. It was part of an intentional strategy to hobble a promising progressive voice, and this was the beginning of the "Obama is an un-American Muslim" smear campaign. Thus began Obama's relationship with Fox News. Fox News is one of the most insidious and dangerous forces in American politics, and much of what ails our civil discourse today can be traced back to Fox and its successors. If you want to know why the Republican Party has become so far out of the mainstream, you only have to look to Fox News. If you want to know why large portions of the Republican Party believe in debunked conspiracy theories about Barack Obama and refuse to believe accurate reports about Trump, look to Fox News. If you want to know why so many Republicans yell fake news and information that challenges their points of view, look to Fox News. If you want to know why nativism and racism are resurgent in the Republican Party, look to Fox News. And if you want to know how we ended up with Trump as president, yet again, look to Fox News. What is Fox News? Fox News was launched in 1996 as the, quote, fair and balanced conservative alternative to the purportedly liberal mainstream media. On paper, this is not a terrible concept. The long-running conservative critique of the mainstream media establishment as liberal is not an entirely incorrect one. Most journalists are socially progressive. They believe in climate change and support marriage equality, a women's right to choose, and gun control. It says a lot about the distorted reality that Fox has helped create that believing in the scientifically proven fact that the climate is changing can be seen as, quote, ideological bias, but I digress. Most reporters don't vote, but if they did, they would probably vote for a Democrat. There's no doubt that this ideological bias bleeds into coverage and commentary, but it's important to separate the difference between ideological bias and political bias. The mainstream media does not skew their reporting to help Democrats win, which is something conservatives have suggested for a long time. They are wrong about that. Just ask Bill and Hillary Clinton. The, quote, liberal media has covered the Clintons with what is, at best, a ferocious skepticism, and at worst, a monomaniacal obsession to prove them guilty of something. Despite the liberal leanings of individual reporters, the overriding bias in the mainstream media is not ideological. It's toward conflict, controversy, clicks, and ratings. However, it would be naive to think that this doesn't lead to some bias in which topics are covered and how they are covered. Most reporters, editors, and television executives live and work in New York City, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C., three of the most liberal cities in America. Their sensibilities are shaped by their surroundings. Democrats unwilling to admit this fairly obvious fact are actually proving the right's point. A TV network that would cover issues from a different perspective is a good idea and a healthy one for our democracy. That sort of network may have been what Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes had in mind when they started Fox News more than 20 years ago. But that's not what it is anymore, or ever was, really. Fox News isn't covering news from a perspective that is outside the elite media bubble. It's not even covering issues from a conservative perspective. Simply put, Fox News is not a news outlet. It is a Republican propaganda machine masquerading as a news outlet that exists to elect Republican politicians and promote their positions, whatever they are at the time. This makes Fox News very different from traditional ideological outlets like the conservative National Review or the liberal Mother Jones. When George W. Bush was president, Fox News was a primary booster of the Iraq War and the Bush administration's quasi-legal, and often illegal, anti-terrorism strategies, often questioning the patriotism of those who disagreed. When Obama became president, Fox News became the loudest critic of Obama's strategies. But their criticism was not that he wasn't tough enough, but that his drone policy and surveillance activities were too tough. When Obama was president, Fox News almost never covered the good news in the economic recovery. But now that Trump is president, the same jobs and growth numbers that were ignored or dismissed under Obama are trumpeted from the rooftops. When Obama was president, the consistent theme was that Obama was not tough enough in his response to Russian aggression in Ukraine and Syria. Now that Trump is president, in part because Russia interfered with our election, Fox News is leading the defense of Trump's pro-Putin foreign policy. Fox's defenders like to draw a distinction between the opinion shows with conservative personalities like Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson and the news division. Some media types like this say that Fox News is the mirror image of MSNBC, news during the day and ideological opinion at night. This argument is complete horseshit. Yes, there are, quote, real journalists at Fox News. Many are veterans of places like CNN and CBS. But they don't do journalism at Fox. Their work is used to serve the larger political goals of Fox News. They work on positive stories about Trump and negative stories about Democrats. They are nothing more than beards for the larger propaganda aims of the network. They sold their integrity to the highest bidder. After a few beers in the hotel bar on a long presidential road trip, some of the Fox staff would admit that the fix was in. But this was a job they were trying to make the best of a bad situation. They suggested we come to them with complaints about the ideological tilt of the network. It was a nice gesture, but complaining about coverage of Obama to Fox News was a little like banging your head against a wall. It wasn't effective, and you felt worse after doing it. There were other journalists at Fox who would never under any circumstances admit that Fox was different from other outlets. They'd swear up and down that they were as objective as the next journalist, and their bosses really wanted to live by their unintentionally ironic slogan, fair and balanced. I can never figure out whether these folks were brainwashed to believe the unbelievable, or they were afraid that Fox News honcho Roger Ailes was tapping their phones. We learned in 2016 that Ailes did spy on his reporters, but after he was fired for being a serial sexual harasser and all-around horrible person, nothing changed in how the network operated. During the Obama era, their story was largely about an effete and un-American president who failed to protect